Yeah, hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I'm Phil Brining, and this week I was joined by Joe Kirk. It's the 7th of February, Joe, 2025?
It
episode
is.
Episode 204, I think.
204, correct. Yes, hello.
Good session?
Good session, yeah, I really enjoyed it actually. I feel like we had three or four topics that we went quite deep into. We spent probably about half of the session talking about cookies, consent and direct marketing. I guess you could wrap them up into one sort of sphere of conversation, couldn't you? But yeah, I think that was my highlight of the week, trying to unpick ICO's consent or pay guidance and whether it is a load of codswallop.
Yeah, that was a good discussion, and it also linked back to the Skybet case, didn't it, where the courts were poring over, you know, consent and valid consent and, you know, capacity of an individual to consent, which I thought again was a really interesting discussion. I liked the discussion about audit, to be honest, as well, because we've been out auditing this week.
Yes.
And that was quite good to talk about auditing security. Well, you know, from a GDPR perspective, what is it we're looking for? You know, are we looking simply for systems to demonstrate that the correct tools are in place and they're evaluated for their effectiveness, or are we actually looking at those tools, you know, in a lot of detail, which requires some technical knowledge? So that was quite a good discussion. And I know I get rabbit on about it, but the that Skybet and also the Mike Ashley v. HMRC, I think that is a really interesting case to get hold of the transcript of and read, because of the way that it goes through historical cases, as well as, you know, asking some really fundamental questions like, what is personal data? You know, what is disproportionate effort? How can this exemption be applied? Brilliant stuff for privileged practitioners to get hold of and have a look through. That's the beauty of the transcripts of the court cases. You get to see how the judiciary is thinking this through and structuring their arguments. And that is all really important for us to be able to do our jobs.
Yeah, going to have a read of those, I think. We also touched on international transfers, didn't we?
We did.
And a little bit on breaches on the end as well. So, yeah, we covered quite a bit of ground.
And then there's just two of us, just thee and me.
Yeah. It's hard, isn't it, when there's just two sometimes?
Yeah,
especially when someone turns to a Dalek for 10 minutes.
Yeah, you did a bit go a little bit croaky. Yes. Well, anyway, and that was what we talked about. So if you want to dive into the detail, then be my guest. Otherwise, we'll catch you on the next one. Interestingly, thank you. Interestingly, I was talking to somebody on Wednesday afternoon. Yeah, somebody, a privacy practitioner, extremely good privacy practitioner in Jamaica. She was involved in crafting the Jamaican law, which is really interesting to talk to her. She's great. But she was saying that she struggles to earn CPD credits for the IAP. So I said, oh, you need to listen to the podcast then. It's very European. In fact, it's very UK-centric. I said, but hopefully it might be useful to get those points clocked up. So I'm going to send her over the way to do that. And I think that, you know, she'll probably not listen in real time because it's about 5 a.m. there at the moment. But she might listen to the recordings.
Yes.
So if she does, hello, Sinead.
Welcome from Jamaica. Is she based in Jamaica then? Yes.
Yeah.
Welcome to Jamaica. Can you see the privacy
notice?
Yes,
can do now. Yes.
Good.
Yes,
excellent.
Yes.
I'll leave it up for a moment or two then.
Thank you. Yeah. So what a week, and you've had a busy week running around auditing.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that. There's actually loads to talk about, Joe, and we're definitely run out of time. I want to talk about Mike Ashley versus HMRC and the subject access request, because there's some I was in heaven about it, because it is absolutely fantastic as a transcript. It's long, it's 52 pages. But what's great is that the judge presiding on this case goes through all the relevant case history, going back to Durrell, and goes through Eden, it goes through some of the other ones that we know, Itihar and all those kind of things. It goes through them all and explains them in simple terms and why they're not relevant to the principles involved in the case. So it's a great read, and the way that the judge positions their decision, again, it's really good to understand why, you know, when they're talking about it was not disproportionate to, you know, etc. It's just good to get on the inside. You feel like you're on the inside track with it. So if you're reading other people's blogs, you know, great, but I would recommend getting hold of it. And at the back of the judgment, the transcript, the judge summarises the whole thing, saying, right, in paragraphs 139 to 146, I'm answering question one, the issue in question one. In paragraphs 135 to 184, I'm articulating my conclusion relating to this. So it actually gives you a really good guide to save you having to read the whole thing as well. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about, international transfers, didn't you? Lots of stuff about cookies.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff about, I've had a look at Uber's new privacy policy, some issues about marketing studies. I reread that Sky Bet, the consent.
Yeah.
Again, that's another brilliant case to read. You get all the transcript and read it. It is brilliant. And other things in the news. So there's probably quite a lot to talk about. But I want to start by talking about our week and our audit. What have you got on your kind of mind to speak about? Anything additional?
Nothing additional, no. I think you've summarised that quite nicely. But I think starting with the audit would be a good place to start, because it's what we've been up to this week. So, yes, we've tried best way to describe it. What do they do? The blood, they do testing, don't they, of samples from people.
Yeah, it's a laboratory. What an amazing environment.
Yeah, I have never, ever seen anything quite like that. When I got into the office today, I was speaking to Kate about it because she asked how it was. And the way it's set up, in terms of the process, how automated it is incredible, isn't it? You know, these samples come in, they get dropped in these little telly lifts, they're called, aren't they? And they go up the wall, take the things up to the following floor in this little cart, and then get dropped off. And they were just, the little samples were flying around, weren't they, on these little carts?
Yeah, but in an completely enclosed environment. So it's I mean, I've been in quite a lot of food production lines in the past, and it was exactly like that. So you've got all these test tubes flying around, each with a barcode on, you know, everything is totally automated, you know, where they go, how long they're there for, which analytics they're subjected to. And they're flying through millions a week, aren't they, of these samples. I mean, this is NHS, you know, it's very, very impressive. But the whole thing is obviously driven by data, which is why we're in there. And, you know, it's all pseudonymized special category data, isn't it? It's all kind of medical related information that's being processed. But what an environment. And it was great fun to get in there. You've got, what, another 5 or 6 days of auditing, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. I think just back on site with them for two more days next week. So I won't get tired of looking out their office window either. Central London, just looking out.
Eighth floor. Yeah.
Not bad at all. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing that we spent a lot of time talking about yesterday, yesterday with them, it was security. When I said to you, well, I think I need to just kind of flag it up on the podcast. You know, when we go in as GDPR compliance assessors, you know, we're thinking about security, you know, what are we looking for? You know, how are we able to, you know, assess whether there is a mechanism for ensuring the technical and organizational measures are appropriate to the environment and the data and the nature and the context of the processing, and what considerations of cost, etc. So one of the things that surprised us was this is such a technological environment that we didn't feel that there was sufficient protections for the power supply to the building, for instance. That was one of the things we thought was a vulnerability. And the reason why there wasn't UPSs and generators was through budgetary constraints. But there must have been an awful lot of money spent on that, developing out that environment. But yeah, you know, if there's somebody sticks a JCB through the power cable, well, that's a big problem for them, isn't it? They've got redundant connectivity, you know, two different broadband connections from different suppliers, different exchanges, different corners of the building. So a bit of resilience built in there. But, you know, I was surprised about that. But it kind of thought, well, we'll throw it out there and just see, you know, how everybody else would approach, you know, auditing security when we're thinking GDPR compliance. You know, so that's one to kind of mull over and chuck in the chat if you've got anything to consider on that front. Because we normally take the view that we've got a bit of a matrix approach, which is quite complicated and time consuming. So we think about the structure of it, the network security, the application security, the device security, the security of the people, the physical security, you know, any legal security, if that is such a thing, across different systems, you know, differently. So when you go to an audit and you know, and you say, do you have multi-factor authentication? And they say yes. You know, the obvious question is on what systems, you know, on which aspects of the processing, and where you haven't got it, why haven't you got it? You know, and but it isn't as simple as do you have multi-factor authentication. It's much, much more nuanced than that. Yes, inside of that again came up. You know, there's certain risks in this environment that we thought, you know, if they're mitigated fully.
Insider threats, is that in terms of staff going AWOL with stuff?
Yeah, rogue staff, yeah. Exfiltration of data, you know, developing duff code to developers. Is that sufficient for really credible peer review? What training do they have to make sure they're aware of present and evolving vulnerabilities? All that type of stuff to try and, you know, nail down your people, really.
Yeah, I mean, security in the GDPR is quite vague, isn't it? It just says you need to make sure you have sufficient measures in place appropriate to the data that you're processing. And in this environment, yes, the data was pseudonymized, but, you know, heavily, highly sensitive stuff in terms of blood tests, and they do some cancer work as well, don't they? So
yeah,
if something goes wrong within that environment, such as you say, someone in the JCB sticks a digger through a power cable, and the power goes down in the whole environment, you know, that could have catastrophic impacts, couldn't it, on the data subjects if the amount of people's tests are going through the thing, you know, a late diagnosis could, you know, could lead to death in, you know, in the worst scenario. So it really was quite a surprise. And was it in the server room as well? They said they had sprinklers, didn't they, I think?
Yeah. Have you got any fire suppressant in your comms and server rooms? Yeah, we got sprinklers. Oh, that's good in an electrical environment.
Yeah, and to be honest, though, IT were frustrated, weren't they? And it was, I think that's something that we often experience as, you know, in security and in data protection, is that we want to do all these things, but often our hands are tied, aren't they, by organisations' budget, and prioritisation just isn't quite where it needs to be. You know, granted, they spent a lot of money moving into the office they were in. They had to strengthen the floors, didn't they? So that because of the weight of the equipment, which I imagine wouldn't be cheap to do. But surely backup generators is top of the priority list in terms of if something goes wrong.
One of the keys, isn't it, for resilience and continuity of processing. But I mean, we were talking about the you know, a big risk, which, you know, you can only cover off through the code, you know, of the applications that you're developing to manage the whole process, is data integrity. If you get samples mixed up, or I told you about the fact, I don't know if you've seen the film Brazil, which is a bit, you know, fanciful. It's a 90s film as well, where this guy is typing up a letter. He works for the secret police or something, and there's a fly buzzing around his room, and he swats a fly, it falls on his typewriter, he types a letter, it comes out the wrong letter. So they arrest the wrong guy. You know, now that's fanciful, but, you know, data integrity is key for that environment, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Sorry, I'm just reading the chat. It's a little bit tricky sometimes when there's two of us, but you're right, it is. Sorry, Lawrence has said, how robust is the average organisation for staff simply downloading data because they can exfiltrate data because they're allowed to connect their phones either to charge or upload data? How many get to that level of detail to know if a particular file is being downloaded? Well, actually, to be fair, yesterday they had corporate devices was the only things, couldn't it, that could access things. They couldn't. You could go on your phone, but there was a viral network, was there, that meant that the data was kind of rerouted through that, as opposed to someone going on their actual phone.
Yeah, if you're accessing remotely to remote desktop into the environment, a virtual desktop. But there were certain controls about it. But they did say that they used the USB stick to renew as well, which, okay, you know, but that they would be encrypted. But we didn't have the time to say, well, show us one, prove to us the process works. You know, that's the trouble they're doing audit, isn't it? You get told stuff, and you don't often get, clients often don't pay for the time for us to verify that what we're being told is actually happening consistently. But I mean, that's all part and parcel and fun of being doing the audits, isn't it? And if we end up, you know, helping support certain things that they want to achieve and prompting certain thoughts they'd not even considered, you know, then, you know, it's a positive outcome.
Yeah, I agree. Kind of navigating into a different area, but kind of from the same thing, kind of as I've been doing audits recently, obviously, you know, we try and do a full scan through the GDPR. if we've got the time, or if, you know, the organisation wants us to focus on specific areas, then we may, you know, miss the odd thing. But international transfers is something that we always kind of look at, because, you know, you look at the ROPA, and in their list, it has to list international transfers. And something that I've come across quite recently is some organisations that say that they don't transfer data outside of the UK. And every time I see that, I don't know about you, Phil, but it just always seems, it just always comes to me as going, I just don't believe you. It's just, it just seems so unlikely, doesn't it, that organisations, especially in this day and age, that the data doesn't leave the UK.
Yeah, and that was the same yesterday. You know, everything says, privacy policy, ROPA says no data export out, you know, no restricted transfers. And, you know, so we get talking to some of the staff, you know, and it transpires that the marketing team, sales team are using Salesforce. Well, you know, what makes you think you're not doing international transfers then? You know, when you look at the Salesforce Trust site, it tells you which sub-processors are using, you know, core parts of the platform and all the peripheral bits, and it tells you where the data is going. And it's places like Brazil, you know, and Canada and the EU. And, you know, so I just get, I get really frustrated with this presumption that just because I don't know about international transfer means it's not happening. It's just absolute frustrating to live in there. It's utter nonsense. And then they started arguing that Ireland was okay. I said, yeah, I know Ireland's okay because it's got adequacy, but it's still a restricted transfer. You still need to catalogue it. I mean, just because it's Ireland doesn't mean to say you're absolved of all responsibility in respect to restricted transfer. I mean, I mean,
they were the two things that I think I've kind of realized is that organizations believe it to be true, because one is that personal data, yes, it's being processed by an international organization, but it's being stored in the UK. But that doesn't always necessarily mean that it's staying in the UK, does it? I mean, Salesforce, for example, I think, do they store our data in Slough, did you say yesterday?
Our main data center.
Backups in Germany, don't they?
Yeah. The instance, you can tell, again, it's all, one of the things I like about Salesforce, it's all there in the public area. Well, not a public domain, but you can go and put your instance and your org ID into a site. It'll tell you exactly where your data is being hosted. Ours is hosted in Slough because we've asked for it to be in the UK. But there's a backup site in Germany, in Frankfurt. Well, at least we're aware of that, you know, and we can put it into our privacy information, into our ROPAs. And then we know that the types of plugins we use, like Conga Composer and, you know, the other ones we use, we know about those as well, because Salesforce provide that information for you. So you can, you know, you've got a fighting chance of getting to a compliant situation. But where you're working with organizations that don't provide that information, you know, it's very dangerous to assume that it's all hunky-dory.
Yeah, and just because data is stored in the UK doesn't mean that it's not being accessed outside of that, does it? Have you got guarantees from that organisation that there's not an employee in US who's going to access that data that's stored in the UK? Because would that not constitute a personal data, an international transfer?
Well, again, that was one of the discussion points we had yesterday, wasn't it? That the ICO's view is that if it's an employee of the legal entity that is like a UK based, then it doesn't constitute an international transfer, does it? You know, but EU takes a different view. If it's a subsidiary company or a different legal entity, then it is a restricted transfer. So again, it's in the reality is there's all sorts of people for all sorts of valid reasons accessing data all over the world, because that's the world we live in. And this is one of the areas where probably the GDPR doesn't quite help reflect reality. I know it's trying to achieve, you know, control over a restricted transfer because it impacts on people's rights to exercise their rights or ability to exercise their rights. But, you know, the reality is it's very hard to map and it's subject to change.
Yeah, I can't remember who an organization I was having a look on. I don't know if it might be MailChimp, but I know they're US-based, so it may not be them. But I'm sure I read somewhere that they store data in the UK, but then they do send it on to, you know, the company in the US. So it's why due diligence is so important, isn't it, to carry out, so you fully understand, if you can, where that data is going, for you to make sure you've got the appropriate safeguards in place.
And some organizers, I did a study on Zoom a few months ago for a client, and again, they've got brilliant information, really helpful. Whether it's a full picture, it's one of those where, you know, if it looks good, is it good? You know, kick the tires as well. But they've got some very helpful information, Zoom, on, you know, what they're doing, where they're doing it, how they're doing it. You know, another good example, I think.
Yes, agree.
Use that in the training that we do. Anyway, so that was that. Yeah, that's been a lot. That was basically this week, wasn't it? The international transfers was an interesting question, though. Now, you wanted to talk about cookies, did you, as well? I mean, you've been doing quite a lot of cookie work, haven't you? And the ICO is now announced that on, like, the second phase of their cookie action. Now, interesting, I just remembered on Tuesday morning I went to see a prospective client to talk through some stuff that they're doing. And they're quite a big football club. And so they got a big website, they got, you know, a big brand, and, you know, I was talking to them about the next wave of cookies. I don't know whether they'll get into the kind of the top 1,000 websites, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they're not. And some of the other clubs, you know, the really big clubs, surely they've got a lot of traffic over there. But what did you want to cover off on cookies? Because, you know, the ICA's made this announcement, haven't they?
They have, yeah. I mean, so me and Kate explored it on the news section of a topical session a few weeks back, but we did say that we'd revisit it because it's quite a chunky piece of work. So it's to do with the ICO's new guidance around pay or consent, or consent or pay, whichever you want to call it, which obviously comes back of them, as you say, contacting the top 1,000 websites across the country. But I think it's worth just starting by saying that cookie compliance is an issue for organisations, isn't it? Even on yesterday's audit, you know, we briefly covered cookies, and I went on the website and there was no cookie banner. You know, this is a big organization, and the frustrations from the data protection team was that they had no control over that. And that astounded me as well, because the website developer is in control of the website. Yes, fair enough. But is it not your duty to inform the website developer of the things you want to have on your website as an organization?
But this is one of the weaknesses you found. You constantly find doing cookie audits, isn't it? That you might have technical controls in there to like OneTrust that tells you about the cookies available, but it's the governance of the cookies where there's usually nothing whatsoever. So everyone talked about a cookie policy being that thing on the website that explains to consumers, you know, what cookies are there. But cookie policy in our book is a policy that determines how cookies are managed, you know, who makes decisions, what's the approval process, how they're catalogued, where they're listed, how they're decommissioned. All that stuff, we never find any evidence of a proper governance over cookies, do we? It's usually, you know, some person in a dark room in the basement who looks after the website, you know, makes the call.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think many organisations have a wrap of the sort of cookies they're placing on their website and what they do. I mean, how many times I think, was it not last, this most recent one, but there was the audit we did the week before, when I look at their cookies. You know, our organizations list sometimes the amount of distinct cookies they have on the website. They had 40 unknown cookies on their website. Well, if you don't know what they're doing, why have you got them on your website? Is my argument. And then if someone goes, hang on a minute, you've took that cookie off. Well, at least then you'll be able to find out what that cookie does, allowing you to categorize it.
Yeah, somebody says, oh, this report stopped working now. Now, Carly is saying that they've got implemented a code, a cookie governance process, which is great. You know, that's exactly what we think people should have, you know, a methodology for managing cookies, not just for telling people all the bits, you know, the compliance bits, but actually to manage their placement and, you know, making sure that they go through an approvals process. And I was reading something about cookies, but I can't think what it was.
Well, while we have a scan through your notes, shall I kind of give a bit of a rejig of what we spoke about a few weeks back?
It was the Sky. You might have been talking about the Sky Bet, and you know the Sky Bet case where there was it's actually a damages case, wasn't it?
We spoke about that last week. The guy who had a gambling addiction?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
Well, only insofar as, you know, again, in the circumstances, which is the whole point about these cases. I read that case, skimmed that case as well this morning, which is, again, a brilliant case to read, because what that one does, it starts exploring the notion of consent. And, you know, you have to read the transcript. I'll put these in the thing in a minute. You have to read the transcript, because the judge is saying that effectively consent is a continuum rather than a Boolean. And, you know, whether it's likely that it's valid consent depends on a whole load of circumstances. In this case, you know, the judge ruled that it probably wasn't valid consent because the person was addicted to gambling, and, you know, therefore it was informed potentially, although they did pick apart their privacy notices. But they weren't in their right mind. They weren't of sound mind to grant consent because they were addicted to gambling. Again, these are edge cases, but the way that the judges go through their rationale, and it's all, you know, written out and you can follow the arguments, it's just a really good practice, I think, to get hold of these cases and scan through them and read the relevant parts in detail.
Yeah, it looks like I'm going to have a little bit of extra work to do on the side then. That's a couple of cases you recommended us to have a read through.
Yeah, I'll find it and stick them in a minute. Now, there's a Guardian article about that as well. But basically, this chap they've called Sam was identified as a high-value customer, blah, 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 blah. Now, he made a subject access request to Skybet, at which point Skybet suspended his account, saying he'd asked some unusual questions. Anyway, he wrote back, said, no, I really want to raise a subject access request. So they sent back a load of information. One of the things they sent back was a spreadsheet, and it says that Sam remembers feeling physically sick. Among unintelligible spreadsheets listing pieces of code, his years of gambling were spelled out in black and white, his history of playing slots, his favourite sport, the number of deposits made since opened account, 2,514, and the completed bets, 44,063. He'd been identified as a high-value customer, somebody that needed to be encouraged, somebody that they were predicting what things he'd be interested in, and then making sure that he saw those bets. Well, we know this is what goes on, don't we? This profiling work. But again, I'll put the links in a minute to these things. Really good to read. Really good to read.
Yes, I'll have to have a read. There's a couple of things in the chat. Amy says, how do you feel about legitimate interest of vendors? And Lawrence says that he always thought that if you're relying on consent, that you cannot rely on legitimate interest, since legitimate interest can only apply if none of the other lawful bases apply. Thus, the legitimate interest for being on a no marketing list is there because consent is not relevant. For example, you say no to marketing, then you need LI for the no marketing list because you cannot use consent for the no marketing list since the consent was not available above. Thus, using consent and LI for the same processing seems wrong to me. Though if you followed that, there was a lot of...
I did, yeah. This is back to the acid test. You know, what is the key question is, what are people consenting to? You know, if they're consenting to the placing of cookies, then, and that is required, then that you know, fine, you don't consent, cookie don't get placed. But what is the legitimate interest? That's always what foxes me. I know what's being said in the chat here. You know, you can't have the two things, I agree. But, you know, if you can't place cookies without consent, then what is it what is the processing that's going to be undertaken based on legitimate interest? Well, presumably it's offline marketing, not based on cookie. I don't know what it is. You know, but it makes you wonder how that works then. If they can't place a cookie because you haven't consented, well, how are they going to know who you are? They're going to track your machine. How are they going to identify your machine when it comes back onto their radar again? I think the ICO has got a big problem with legitimate interest being used in respect to cookies because, again, they don't think, apart from strictly necessary, that it's at all appropriate, do they?
I tend to agree with that, to be honest. I mean, what is the use of cookies? It's to track and profile people, isn't it? Which is... you know, it always feels quite invasive. How invasive does it feel when you're having a conversation with somebody and you go on Instagram or Facebook and then an advert pops up for that thing that you were talking about? I don't know about you, but I feel exposed. So, you know, it's privacy invading processing. Do you not feel?
It absolutely is, yeah. But, you know, the counter to that is if everyone's doing it, you know, everyone's doing that. That's just a kind of the way that things are potentially these
days. Yeah, but it's about giving you the choice, isn't it, of whether you want that to happen to you or not.
Well, it should be. Yeah,
And that actually puts us on quite nicely to this consent or pay thing, because we're not really given a choice, are we, in the ICO? I don't know if you've read the guidance. Me and Kate did speak about it a little bit, but you weren't here, so I'm happy to unpick it, because I hope that you're in agreement with me and Kate that we just can't see how consent or pay can work while complying with the UK GDPR. So just to give you and the listeners a little bit of background kind of around what consent or pay is that when you go onto a website such as The Sun, I know that they do it, you either consent to online or cookies being placed in order for them to profile you and send you targeted ads, or you pay a fee to not be tracked, essentially. And the ICO has produced some guidance saying that consent or pay models can be compliant with data protection law if you can demonstrate that people can freely give their consent and the models meet the other requirements set out in the law. The guidance provides a set of factors to assess whether people can freely give their consent or not in the context of a consent or pay model. you must demonstrate your assessment and be able to justify how your consent or pay model is compliant with the UK GDPR and the PECA, taking into account the factors set out in this guidance. You should consider these factors in the round in your assessment. Further information about how to use these factors to support your assessment is detailed below. And the four factors were power imbalance, appropriate fee, equivalence, and privacy by design. But then there were some other aspects that are bigger than kind of that is, and the main one, and I actually put a LinkedIn post about it last week, it's about the withdrawal of consent. Because the withdrawal of consent should not detriment the processing. So surely withdrawing your consent and being forced to either pay for the removal of the cookies or the website results in the detriment to the processing, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's quite straightforward to me. So I don't understand how they're trying to justify that, you know, these fees are legal. I just don't get it. And then you've got the right to object to marketing as well. So the ICO even says in the guidance that Articles 12 and 21 of UK GDPR make clear that if you process personal data for the purpose of direct marketing, you must demonstrate that people can exercise their right to object free of charge. If they do object, you must stop using their data for direct marketing. The guidance explains that the definition of direct marketing includes processing for personalized advertising purposes, which in this case happens. And in the context of consent or pay models, the right to object to direct marketing can operate in the same way as withdrawing consent to personalized advertising. So that just backs up my argument, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. But you know how we, well, I'm saying you know how we got here. If one assumes that we, you know, we've got here from the fact, you know, that the law is, you know, you're expected to read it, interpret it, understand it, apply it. You know, you're expected. It's like the speeding limit, isn't it? You know, it's funny. I was on the train yesterday. And my daughter WhatsApp saying, "What are you playing at? 117 miles an hour." I said, "I'm on a train." You know, but you know, if you could do 117 miles an hour down the M62 or the M1 if you wanted to, but you face consequences if you do, you know,
yeah.
or killed, you know, if you're involved in an accident maybe, but. You know, data protection laws are a bit the same, isn't it? There's the rules, stick to the rules. Make sure you can evidence that you're sticking to the rules. So, you know, the ICO closes off or publishes some guidance saying, actually, we're not comfortable with this. Well, then industry, marketers, whatever, you know, they sit around the table or, you know, physically or just evolves over time. And they say, oh, this is a great idea. Why don't we try this? You know, and somebody's probably looked at it and said, well, that maybe is okay, or maybe it's not okay, but you can do it until it's proven not to be okay. So we don't know quite how the decision maker gets done, but you know, it's not actively policed, is it? That's the biggest problem of all with this GDPR, the PECA. You know, it's not, ICO is not, I don't think, that proactive in pushing out, you know, fast guidance and no, you can't do this. That's not what it means. You know, stop it, otherwise we're going to get upset about it. They just let things bumble along for years. This is going on for years, consent or pay. And it's more prevalent on mobile devices, isn't it? If you look at the news on the mobile device with The Guardian, for instance, and lots of newspapers, you get consent or pay. Independent is one. But if you look on a browser on a computer, you don't get the same consent or pay options on the independent.
Not?
No.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So it's much more prevalent on mobile devices.
I wonder
and again,
why
I
that
think.
Is.
Well, I think considering you in your pocket, you know, and
right, yeah,
you know, there
you're more likely to go on your phone, aren't you, than your laptop onto a news article.
Well, and then you use the phone for other things. That then is, you know, if the cookie's placed on your phone, that potentially is more valuable than if a cookie's placed on your laptop.
Yeah, that's a very good point actually. But your point about kind of other, Leon, it is quite prominent in news organizations who provide news. And that leads on to another point of the ICO's guidance, and it was to do with assessing the power of imbalance. So they said that if you operate a consent or pay model, you must be able to demonstrate that people have freely given their consent. Mm. This means that you must be able to show that people have a genuine free choice and would not be unfairly penalised, saying that to ensure that people can freely give their consent, you should carry out an assessment of whether there is a clear imbalance of power between you and the people that use your product or service. Saying that you should document this assessment and keep it under review, particularly if you subsequently change your consent or pay model. And they said that there's other factors that can cause a power imbalance, and they said you should consider the factors that might lead to a clear power imbalance, meaning you can exercise a free choice in your assessment, including considering the extent to which people rely on your service and whether they will suffer an unfair penalty if you refuse their consent. So that, to me, says that news articles absolutely is a clear imbalance of power.
Yeah, they've got the knowledge and you haven't.
Yeah, exactly. And your choice is you either pay it or you don't know about what's going on in the world.
Yeah. I think you quite make a very valid point. You're quite right. I mean, this, again, talking consent, cookie consent, marketing consent, this brings us back to the Skybet case. Again, well worth reading, because the notion of consent is explored to a great extent in that court, in that transcript, that case transcript. There's a few things on the chat. I did read, I'd have put a link to it, an article, a study actually, a finding, which is quite interesting, because it's saying that there's clear benefits to ethical data practices, and that a large proportion of consumers, 82% of consumers, are concerned about privacy, and, you know, don't like the intrusiveness of it. But 67% are willing to accept personalized marketing when presented with a clear value proposition. So they call in this kind of the paradox, the marketing paradox. You know, on the one hand, everyone's like us, up in arms about it. And on the other hand, we're saying, yeah, bring it on. You know, it potentially is a tricky path to tread for direct marketers, potentially. But what this is saying is that, you know, if you can be transparent and you've got, you know, good ethics behind your policies, then you got more chance of winning over consumers and keeping them.
But that's the issue, though, isn't it? Because they don't have good ethics behind it, because it's, I think direct marketing is one of those things. If you marketed something that you're interested in, it doesn't feel like, you know, too bad, does it? But then if, for example, this gentleman who's got a gambling addiction, he sent ads for Bet365 or other gaming sites or whatever, that's where the issue kind of, you know, there's a big issue there, isn't there, as opposed to receiving things that you are actually open into looking at. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, cookies, your favorite topic, isn't it? One of your favorite topics.
I do enjoy cookies, yes, because I think the law is quite straightforward, as opposed to the GDPR is open to interpretation. You know, well, until we've spoken about this, you know, consent, you either get someone's consent or you don't place a cookie, unless it's strictly necessary for the function of the website. But
and that's clear. But what isn't clear, if you kind of read the cases, is what constitutes valid consent, you know, what's reliable consent. And interestingly, again, this, going back to Skybet, you know, this person established a relationship with Skybet in 2017 before GDPR. So again, it goes through the process of evaluating their privacy information and whether it complied with the 98 Act, and then how they updated that and refreshed their consent in 2018, and whether that actually was a robust process or not. So again, it's a fascinating read, actually, if you've got your right head on for it.
Yes, I'll have to have a flick through and read that. Kind of while we're on the topic of consent, something that I've often experienced with when I've been helping some of my customers, when typically the marketing team is saying, you know, they've sent these mechanisms over and they're not quite in line with, you know, the conditions of consent and the definition of consent. So, you know, that we're saying that, look, you need to go out and get consent again. And the pushback is, oh, we don't want to reattain consent because, you know, we feel like people are going to say no at that point. But what I find is that consent doesn't last forever. You know, you have to refresh your consent. So you have to do an exercise at some point anyway. So I always just feel like the argument from marketing teams is always a bit mute, because you're always going to have to refresh your consent regardless of whether it's now because the consent's invalid or because you've collected valid consent and it doesn't last forever. So you've got to renew it.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't last forever. How long it lasts for, who knows? But I think, you know, there's this comfortable feeling maybe of having a big database despite the vast majority of it being inactive, and having, you know, a small database, which is more engaged. I'd like to think if I was in marketing, I'd be wanting the latter, you know, a very engaged, manageable database. But I think most of the time it seems to be a numbers game, get the most in and, you know.
I think it depends who you're marketing to as well. I mean, you know, you always give examples when you worked at Everton. You do direct marketing to Everton football fans that people want to hear from the club and what you're interested in, because they have an affiliation with that football club. Whereas if you've got direct marketing from somebody you don't want to hear from and they're bombarding you with stuff and you're like, look, I've had enough, that's going to, you know, the data subject's going to probably have more of an issue with that, as opposed to continuous direct marketing from something that you're actually interested in.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Now, I don't know if you saw, there was a FOIA breach in a school, which was interesting. So this happened in Wellesway School in near Bristol. It was in the BBC. They've reported themselves to the Information Commissioner's Office. They basically had a withdrawal room. or it might be in a quiet room. Anyway, the children get sent to this particular room, and then that gets recorded in a spreadsheet. And it's usually when there's allegedly bad behaviour, or you know they need to cool down or whatever. I can't remember what they call the room here. The school's withdrawal room. So if somebody put in a FOIA request because their daughters kept getting sent to the withdrawal room, and they thought it was being used excessively, and it was interrupting her education. Anyway, the school did a FOIA responded to the FOIA request and sent out a spreadsheet. 2 weeks later, they found out that spreadsheet had 86,000 lines of sensitive information in it, including the name and the date of birth of the children who'd been sent to the, what did I call it, withdrawal room, whether they had special educational needs or educational health or care plan, whether they had child protection orders, and whether the pupils were eligible for free school meals. Again, why would you keep all that on a spreadsheet? But anyway, it was. So that got, you can imagine what's happened, like a hidden sheet with something.
Yeah.
Again, it's just a lack of technical knowledge to be able to manipulate the tools for the job. But what tools are we using for the job?
Agree, but and I know this, we always try to say, look, stay clear of Excel if you can. And we understand that organisations are constrained with money. But if you are going to use Excel, password protect your documents. You know, it doesn't take long, does it, to put a password up?
No, but this is a FOIA request, so you'd have sent the password anyway, with respect. But wouldn't you, if you're like, here's
I
the...
guess, yeah, okay. Yeah. But you do it. Would you not? You not do a check on the data that you're sending over to make sure that it's appropriate to what's being sent?
You'd have thought somebody in the sign-off process would have said, right, let's have a look at what you're sending out. But do they know what they're looking for? Is it a hidden sheet? You know, is it hidden rows?
People do hide things in the Excel where it's, you notice sometimes I'll be looking at things and I'm like, this doesn't, I'm looking at Roper, for example, like this, it was like it's missing stuff.
Chunks missing, yeah.
Didn't have it in November, I remember it vividly. I thought, where's all the stuff here? Got on site, you unclick and bang, 200 rows pop up. You think, that's where everything is, all makes sense now. So yeah, that was probably the,
Peter's spot on, because this is exactly what happened with the PSNI, wasn't it? You know, a spreadsheet response to a FOIA request. Is it we're all under pressure, time pressure? The quickest thing to do is to grab that data, whack it into a Excel sheet and push it out. But, you know.
Yeah, how long do you have to respond to a FOIA? Is it
20 days, I think. 20 days, correct me if I'm wrong, everyone. I think it's 20 days.
So it's not long then, is it? But surely you'd rather give everything securely than give things a little bit late than potentially breach
20 working days. Yeah,
you know, 86,000 people's data just because you want to make the 20-day deadline.
Yeah, so I saw that was quite like a jaw-dropping moment as well this morning. What else have you seen, Joe? Anything there's been quite an interesting, I'm not sure I can talk accurately about it just yet, but there's been another change in the PCI. So they brought out PCI version 4.0 in March last year, and then in October they brought out PCI 4.0.1, i.e. a revision to version 4, and then on last week there was another revision, but only to the self-assessment questionnaire A, which a lot of people use if they've just got e-commerce and they're outsourcing all the functionality. So at the moment you have to have some, the only way effective to do it is to put some extremely expensive software on your website to scan and manage and collate all the scripts that are running on your website. You have to have a library of scripts, you have to verify your script is valid before it's placed, you know, called when somebody visits your website. This is to stop people replacing the scripts with their own scripts. They're called magic art attacks, where you know, get diverted off by an attacker. But anyway, apparently, and I haven't read the full thing about it, apparently they're changing it so that merchants don't have to necessarily apply those scripts, but I've got to verify that their site is secure, and I'm not sure how they do that. So I've got to read about it. Kenny's on top of that, but that was something else I noticed, which hopefully I'll talk about. I'm not here next week, week after next.
We'll save it for 2 weeks then. I didn't see too much, but I'm just conscious that we're running not out of time, 15 minutes left, and I think you wanted to speak about the Mike Ashley SAR case.
I did. You're quite right. Yes, thank you for that. Yeah. Now, you read that, didn't you, as well?
Not the full thing, but I've read a little bit around it, yes.
Right, again, I would recommend everyone put some time into it. I'll find it and I'll stick it in the thing. I mean, we probably should do a summary of it, but people are doing summaries of it, but I'm not sure, to be fair, they get the essence of it. Everything I've read has been Mike Ashley wins, da, 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 but they don't seem to be actually focusing on the decision-making process. But you know, the case starts off by contradicting what is personal data. And again, what's fascinating is that the courts are referring to the Article 29 Working Party and Duran and all sorts of, you know, historical things, the opinion in 27 from the Working Party, which is a surprise. Really, I thought that, you know, the ICO's view is, when I spoke to the ICO about doing the housing code of conduct, and we were saying we want to refer to some European opinions, I said, oh, no, they don't apply. Yet the courts are saying, you know, we're going to take view of European cases and opinions from the Working Party 29 and the European Data Protection Board. So it starts off thinking about what is personal data, which is good. And again, it's a good academic exercise to go through that process. This is tax information, you know, from Mike, that Mike Ashley has got. And it starts getting into, well, is it information? Does it relate to him? And they draw the conclusion that some of the stuff that he asked for actually isn't personal data and shouldn't be disclosed.
Because he asked for everything relating to the assessment of his tax liability, didn't he, stating that it automated the personal data due to the nature and potential effect that excise might have on him. Yeah, and I saw that the court disagreed, didn't they?
Not all of it. So they disagreed because he wanted policies. I want to know the policy on this. And they said, well, that's not personal data. The way the policy has been applied to you is personal data and the correspondence around that. But the actual policy itself isn't. The internal workings of the HMRC aren't. The way it's been applied to you is. So again, a really nuanced distinction, which is, when you think about it, it's really quite interesting to, you know, to think about the fact that is how it is. It's purpose orientated, isn't it? Is this personal data? Is it relating to you, or is it not? You know.
Yeah, and then you can't go the other way either, can you? You can't just start sending, you know, random snippets of personal data if the context doesn't really make sense of what's going on.
Yeah. Just trying to find the link here. We've got the link somewhere to the, here it is, the HMRC thing. So it starts off by considering, you know, what is personal data. And the thing that I think that why I'm suggesting everyone reads it is because it goes in to think about what is a reasonable and proportionate search. And again, we've come from a position of, you know, the ICO says leave no stone unturned in their guidance. Then the courts say that Dawson, was it Deere? Yeah, Oxford University v Deere, you know, right, you've spent 500,000 man hours or pounds, can't remember which, on this, that's enough, that's a proportionate search. All right, we can apply the notion of proportionality. Then the court said, oh, no, you can't. I can't remember if that was I can't remember that one. And then the court said, oh, you can. Well, now this one's saying, well, you can in certain circumstances. So again, really interesting to step through that thought process about why are they, because what I love about this is they go through each of those cases and say, well, in this case, they ruled in this way because of that. In this case, they ruled that way because of the other. So you get a real good overview of those cases as well by reading this transcript.
Yeah, nothing like to confuse you, though, with contradicting statements from the court.
No, but that's what we like about this field of work.
Yeah, but it's probably a good job that the Dewar Bill is going to, isn't the Dewar Bill acknowledges what proportionate means, doesn't it? In one of the new proposed changes, I believe, around SARS was
They're not going to be able to do that.
I don't know. I can't remember what the word
is. It's so circumstances oriented. And again, that's what the judge says. It depends on the circumstances. And in some of these cases that come to court, there are extreme circumstances and they can't be picked up and assumed to be applicable to other circumstances, which may on face value look similar. And the other thing that why this is really interesting is because they start exploring the exemption, the tax exemption. HMRC starts saying, oh, we can't release this because we've got a tax exemption. And again, the courts are poring over that, saying, well, you know, this exemption has got these caveats. You know, how would disclosing this information be prejudicial to your requirement to, you know, manage taxation? And they find it in these circumstances for the information requested, it wouldn't. So they say, you know, this exemption can't be applicable in these circumstances. But again, we can take that and we can apply it to other exemptions that we do use, you know, like management forecasting and confidential references and legal professional privileges and you know, maybe those at risk of harm. We can think about how the courts go through its thought making process and we can learn from that and apply it to our own more specific circumstances. And again, that's what I love about this kind of stuff, because it's going through, I think, in a reasonably easy to consume way. I mean, they're a bit long, the transcripts, a bit wordy, but you know, a couple of strong coffees, you'll be all right.
Yeah, or a couple of pints down the pub.
Maybe so, yeah. Maybe so. So anyway, yeah, enough said about that, but it was really good. You read something about it as well, didn't you? Is it? What did you read about it?
Yeah, pretty similar stuff, just saying that context matters in terms of, you know, what someone's asking for. Stating that, you know, as I mentioned, that organizations shouldn't just provide small random snippets of data completely out of context and expect the data subject to be okay with it, you know, especially if the person knows what it's about. So in this case, he knows that it's about a tax assessment, right? So even though you're just sending small snippets of stuff, you know, context is really key, saying that it's necessary for the individual to understand, you know, the personal data, you know, should be provided.
Yeah. Yeah, all interesting stuff. Now, we haven't got time to kind of talk about other news. I saw the Met Police have requested transcripts from Prince Harry's phone hacking case. I mean, interested to see what happens with that. You know, this is a kind of a disclosure request that's come in. You know, how will that get handled? Will that get fulfilled? You know, what would get redacted? Interesting to think about, I suppose.
I thought I saw that they've said they're not going to get them.
Matt. I saw this earlier in the week.
I might be dreaming. Right. I don't know.
No, you're probably not. You're probably not. I'm probably working on old news because I haven't consented.
Oh, yeah. So not updated with the news stories.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I didn't really see anything else. But one thing that I did kind of want to bring up is personal data breaches, actually. It's just come to my mind, actually, while we're just sat here thinking about, you know, we mentioned about context, how important it is. I think when it comes to understanding whether a personal data breach is reportable to the ICR or not, context to that breach is so, so key. So often you see when you look at people organizations, breach reporting forms or kind of the procedure around reporting breaches, you often have these sort of matrix how to, you know, to score a breach. Saying if, you know, special category data is involved, then, you know, you get like a 9 or something, and if it's 10,000 people, you get an 8, and then the other way around. So if it's personal data kind of around, you know, an address and a number that it goes to one person, then it's really low level stuff, so that it's not, you know, it then falls under the threshold of Article 33. But that's not always the case, is it? The context of what's going on is so important. So to kind of use this in a scenario, if I have one person's name and address, and I share it with one other person, that person is an ex-abuser of that one person, then that is, you know, a risk to the individual's rights and freedoms. But if I followed a matrix saying that went to one person, it was a name and address, they're all low-level stuff. I just feel like those sort of matrices could put an organisation in a sticky situation when it comes to deciding whether a breach's report or not to the ICO.
I think you're right. I mean, I think there's useful to have that level of guidance and some indication of how to evaluate risks and effectively score them. But you're right. I was reading somebody's policy the other day, which I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was basically saying if it was a high risk data subject, then it gets reported. But that's not what it says, is it? Yeah. I said this will lead to non-compliant behaviour. You know, organizationally, is that a problem? I think it might be, actually, the question. But you know, you're right. The context is key, isn't it? You know, and the scoring matrices are quite useful. But again, somebody has to be making a decision rather than it just being, well, it's come out at a 2. I'm not going to bother reporting it.
Yeah, and the same goes the other way. If you send, you know, in this example, the children's data, what was 89,000 lines, was there?
86,000, yeah.
Yeah, with, you know, highly sensitive stuff. But that goes to
it went to a couple, right? It went to a couple, and the couple have verified they've erased it.
Yeah.
They've read it, thought, oh, blimey, what, shouldn't have had this stuff. Better highlight this to the BBC or whoever they've highlighted it to. The school, school says, oh, no, that's bad. Can you delete it? Yeah, we've deleted it. So risk contained?
I think so, yeah. And then it's up to you as an organisation if you want to make a decision to, because it's a school, you know, what's the consequence of this being leaked by the parents to the news? You might feel like you have a duty to inform the ICO, you know, outside of that. You know, I guess you could do that, couldn't you? So, you know, you might say, why did you do it? And say, look, we're going to hold our hands up. We've put ourselves, you know, we've put our foot in it. But we feel it's right to kind of, you know, notify you and the data subjects as well. I think comes down to kind of organizational choice, but Yeah, absolutely. I think if you send a large amount of special character data, it goes to one person who has ties with your organization, you know, the chance of them using it maliciously is quite low, would you say, especially if they notify you of the breach?
Yeah, I mean, you know, is it what's the likelihood of there being a risk to data subjects? Arguably, it is now low because they haven't got access to that data. But I think it was right to report it. You know, I think that there is a glimmer of a chance. But irrespective of that, you know, it wouldn't be good for it to get out that this has been leaked. And then for the ICO to say, what happened? You say, well, we didn't think it was serious enough to report. We didn't think there was any risk at all.
Sorry, apparently my sound's gone. Kate has been sat trying to work out what's going on with my headphones. I don't know if you're all hearing it.
Yeah, we can. You do sound like a Dalek. Yeah.
Right. I thought somebody said
he sounds like Dilek, but I thought Dilek doesn't sound like Joe.
Has it been for the full session or just now?
No, just the last hour or so. No, just the last 10 minutes or so.
Well.
Yeah. Have you switched it off and on again? Anyway, one of the other things I saw this week, Joe, was Uber updated their privacy information. I don't know if you've seen that.
I haven't seen it. I've unplugged my mic and now it's coming out of my laptop, so I've got no idea what's going on. I've lost you completely.
Oh, it's a lot clearer.
But it's because it's speaking
as opposed to my headphones.
Right. Oh, well, we've only got a few minutes.
You're
left,
back so through just, now, anyway. Is that
so
better?
It's fine. Yeah, just bear with it. So yeah, I thought, this would be interesting to have a look at, and so I clicked on Uber's privacy notice, which is actually quite good, quite interesting. And then I thought they got quite a big section on automated processes. Oh, that'd be interesting to go and have a look at. So I clicked on that, and you end up going down this rabbit warren of information. But you know, it is quite reasonable, actually. So they talk about them, how they the algorithms, they don't tell you how they work, but they said we've got algorithms for matching riders and drivers. Yeah, I kind of probably get that. And then they've got this statement about, you know, when they're using algorithms to determine pricing, and one of the things that they talk about is surge pricing. Again, that's quite interesting, but then you have to go through several other layers to find out more about surge pricing. You don't actually find out what pricing is being undertaken to determine the surge price, but it talks about, you know, supply and demand factors. It's quite interesting stuff, quite informative actually. And then there's a bit about fraud prevention, and then there's a lot of stuff about advertising, which again I wasn't fully aware, probably naive, the extent to which Uber sells your data to advertisers and third parties.
No, I'm not aware of that. I'm not really considered it either, I don't think. So I think I'm in the same boat as you.
Yeah, I got not to harp on about it, because I don't like harping on about things, you know, as you well know. But the Skybet thing, again, he's going through that sort of thing, these privacy notices that you scroll through and click on, and the judges having an opinion about whether, you know, whether that's an applicable technique, you know. Again.
Yeah, and a point I'd like to make though about privacy policies is just because it's in there doesn't necessarily mean that the data subject's going to be aware of it. So it's why it's so important that your privacy policy is as short and succinct and as easy to read as possible, right? Because if it's in there, but it's sat in a very... if it's sat in a page, 50-page document, and it's just tucked away, then in my eyes, you're not meeting your transparency requirements under the law.
It's hard, isn't it? Yeah.
You're not informing them of what's actually going on with the data. So it's. Yeah. I'm always very critical of privacy policies. Me, when I'm reviewing them, I hate seeing things in there that aren't needed. You know, security. Some people love to have sections on marketing, and I saw purpose orientation in one the other day. I just thought, if it's not a requirement of Article 13, don't put it in there. But that's just me.
Mm. Now we've run out of time, Joe. There's still lots to talk about, but we've sadly run out of time. What are you doing next week?
You're auditing again,
aren't you?
I am auditing 2 days next week, and I've got some podcast prep to do. I need to do an audit write-up for the audit we did last week that has done a little bit but has kind of been neglected somewhat. So busy week for me next week, and we've got a podcast. Miles has turned it into a Valentine's Day themed one. I'm not sure how. I think we're looking at Grindr and Tinder.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. I'd like to be on that, because I think it'd be quite interesting to talk about profiling and, you know, what is publicly accessible data in what kind of context. There's lots of stuff to unpack there. Sadly, I'm not going to be on that because I'm off to Ireland next weekend. So.
Oh, very nice. Well, do give us a list of things that you would potentially look at, and we'll do some digging and see if we can do it justice for you.
Okie dokie. Yeah, I'll bring flowers. Yeah, so the digital flowers for Joe and Kate.
Yes, or send them to the office. We'll the
Don't
email
say that, I'd be
address.
inundated with flowers.
Yeah, I've never received flowers, so please do send me some if you fancy it.
Right. Anyway, on that note, thank you very much, everybody, for your contributions. Loads in the chat there and some really good stuff that everyone's chucking into the mix, which is brilliant. Thanks, Joe. It's always good to have someone to chat to about this kind of stuff. Hope everyone has a great weekend, and we will see you. Well, I won't see you next week, but we'll see you in a fortnight, and Joe will see you next week.
Cheers, guys.
Brilliant.
See you later.
Yeah.